Today's program has been brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing, from cake making to wine tasting. For more information, visit internationalculinarycenter.com. Broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to heritageradionetwork.org.
And welcome to Cooking Issues. This is Dave Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues, coming to you live every Tuesday from roughly 12 to roughly 12:45 on the Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting out of the back of Roberta's Pizzeria in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Joined, as usual, with Nastasha Hammer Lopez. How you doing?
Good, how are you?
And the whole crew in the engineering rooms. Give a shout out.
Yeah, we're here.
Yeah, okay.
And you were right on time today.
I know it. You know,
I went up at 12.
Maybe I'm just getting faster on the bike.
It's awesome.
Yeah? Maybe I feel like I'm getting less in shape, so I doubt that's the case. Maybe I actually left on time today.
It's possible.
Nah, I doubt it. Probably not. So anyway, the Cooking Issues crew, Nastasha and I, along with Tristan Willey from our Bar Booker Index, were on the Jimmy Fallon show yesterday for the second time, right?
Yeah, second time.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. They put a picture of my kids, Booker and Dax, up with the with their bartender's mustaches on, thanks to Nastasha, who emailed them the picture. But they were a great crew, right?
They were a great crew.
They were. I made a chocolate drink for Questlove as well, which was a lot of fun. Anyway, enough about us. Okay. William writes in, I hate peeling potatoes. I actually like peeling potatoes. It's weird. It's like, you know how, like, in every book about like a famous
sailing
chef
novel.
Well, no, it's like, for instance, okay, so like, you ever read Ruhlman's book, Soul of a Chef?
No.
Right? No.
I
anyway,
haven't.
You have it, you just haven't read it? It's not that long. I mean, you could read it.
I'm not interested. I don't want to understand.
Why do you have
the Soul
it?
Of a Chef? Well, cuz I was like, "Oh, okay, Mark, I'll get a Soul of a Chef." And then I was like, "Nah."
So it was enough like what?
I wanted to try to understand and commiserate with the chef dating a chef. I just haven't gotten around to reading it.
But not only have you not... No, wait.
I choose not to read it.
You choose not to read it.
I chose to read 50 Shades of Grey.
What's that about?
Nothing, I'm joking.
What is that?
Some people will know.
Did
it.
You really read it?
No! Oh,
what is that? What is 50 Shades... What the hell? Am I behind everything? What the hell?
Yeah, you are.
I'm like 80 years old. I don't know. I don't know what's going on. I don't know what any of the people are reading these days. I know nothing except about food technology these days, I guess. Like, it's pathetic. Anyways, so you bought... It was enough to buy it to mm-hmm. be like, hey, Mark, look, I own this book. Aren't I nice?
I kind of care, yeah.
Yeah, but I don't want to read. I'm not interested. Nah. Anyways, so in that book, like, they make a lot of hay over Thomas Keller liking to wash dishes, as though it shows a sign that he's interested in all aspects of what goes on in the restaurant and the search for perfection, not just, you know, the finished cooking preparation, but everything from cooking dishes and scrubbing pots and all the way up. Really, I think he's just a psycho and likes to scrub pots. It's like, I like juicing limes and lemons, and I don't mind peeling potatoes. Do you know what I mean? It's just, it's like a zen thing for me. It's not like because I care about the little things, which is also true. It's just I don't mind doing that freaking job.
Mm-hmm.
Cooks are weird. Anyway, back to the question. I hate peeling potatoes. Is there an alternative shortcut to peeling potatoes other than the blanch for 15 minutes, dunk in ice water, and rub the skin off? I tried this technique with large russets, but it was quite messy and a pain in the patukas, and feel that using a peeler would have been easier. Thanks, William. Well, William, you know, I've never actually used that technique for peeling potatoes. I peel all my potatoes with a Y peeler. I can rip through. I've only really ever had to do like 20 pounds at a time, though. So I don't know if you're doing like a whole bunch. I would bet anything under 10 pounds or even 15 pounds, you're going to be much faster, I think, just busting out with a Y peeler. The only advantage, I think, of the blanch is if you're not going to soak them in water right away after you peel them. I peel them and directly throw them into water. The blanching will probably kill the enzymes right at the surface of the potato and therefore stop the potato from discoloring. So if you weren't going to throw it into water right away after you peel it, then maybe that blanch would help you on that. But I would just use a Y peeler. If you are doing more than like 20, 30 pounds of these at a time and you have space in your kitchen, they do sell for not that much money. Nils used to use them in Sweden, actually, because the restaurants he used to work with in Sweden, it's like basically all they served were potatoes and herring and salmon. That was it. potato staring. I'm just kidding, but that's not really though. And so they had these abrasive peelers, and the way an abrasive peeler works, it's a drum, and it's got sandpaper on the inside, on the bottom of the drum in a wavy shape, and the drum spins, and you pour water into it, and the potatoes literally tumble around and produce like a potato peel sludge. And the longer you run it, the more crap that you get off of it. And that's how, like, larger restaurants that do a lot of potatoes sometimes get those. I think they're more common in Europe. And that's how potatoes are peeled in big potato factories, abrasively. And then they'll also a lot of times use a high-pressure water jet to spray on the potatoes as well, because that'll blast out any of the dark areas that are on a potato. See, here's the other thing, right? If you're going to blanch and then rub this stuff off, you're still going to need some sort of a knife or a peeler to get rid of all the black spots that are on the insides of the potatoes. And, you know, that's why – this is another thing. People who don't peel their potatoes beforehand. I mean, the problem with not peeling your potatoes beforehand is that there are plenty of potatoes that look sound after you wash them. You know, you scrub them and you wash them. But after you peel them, you notice the black spot underneath. So if you're not peeling your potatoes before, you know, you make french fries and stuff, then you have to pick through all the french fries and worry about all the black spots, right? No? Mm-hmm. Anyway, my two cents. But sorry, I didn't really help there. I think a lot of times when people are their peeling's not as fast as it otherwise could be using a regular peeler. It's just because they're using a traditional straight peeler instead of the Y-shaped peeler. In fact, the my favorite, you know, is, and I feel like I'm shilling for these guys because I also talk about their pressure cooker. I've never received a single thing from the Kuhn Recon Corporation, but they're relatively inexpensive and colorful Y peelers. Work great. They cost like $4, and they're so much faster than the metal kind of more professional style Y peelers whose blade geometry I don't think is correct, or any of the other expensive ones, the cheap plastic one. And they come in a bunch of different colors, which is nice because you can be like, yo, mine's the green one. It's the green one. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'd stay away from the serrated edge peelers. They're theoretically for peeling soft things where I don't know. I've never had any damn luck with them. Nastasha likes them for some reason. She likes the way they look. You like the serrated peeler look.
I do.
But not in, there's no sort of functionality that you care about, right?
No.
No. Yeah. All
right.
Hold on.
Got right. A tweet in about the Fallon show.
Oh, yeah? What'd they say?
Most amazing thing about the Fallon appearance is cooking issues didn't drop the F-bomb once.
Oh, someone must know me. Someone tweeted in.
What's his name did?
Who?
Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
He dropped the F-bomb?
Yes.
I couldn't watch. I was working.
There was nothing to do.
Like, nothing for you to do. You're sitting around in the fish room.
I'll talk to you after.
Yeah. All right. Nothing to do. Tristan and I were sitting there prepping the stuff out during
He's
the
not with the producers. Well, I said I'll talk to you after.
Yeah, and you wouldn't know because where were you not with
Every
me working
I
with Tristan?
In, they said, okay, we'll talk about it after.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So it makes Heritage Radio better than Fallon. We'll let you drop F bombs.
I know, but I don't.
I know, we appreciate that. Well, that's where we had that write-in once, and they said their kids listen. And
Yeah.
By the way, that's classic Nastasha, for those of you that don't know her, is to talk about something. She was not even with me during the entire thing. She was working on email on the computer. They have these weird little rooms, and they all have weird names. We were in the fish room, right? And they had like all sorts of weird cereal boxes on the side wall. But that's where Nastasha was chilling most of the time, right?
Right.
Okay. And also from William, I've been catching up on older podcasts, and in one you mentioned about not having the resources to buy certain things to test out for the listeners. Why not putting up a donation link on the site? I'm sure many of us are happy to donate. After all, you're giving us a wealth of info. William McGee. That's a good idea.
It is.
Right?
Yeah.
Nastasha, look into that.
Listeners can donate to Heritage Radio on our homepage.
But will that buy us cooking equipment to test out for our readers?
No.
Check with Aaron on that.
That's funny. Okay. Joe writes in, Amazon.com is advertising Myhrvold's modernist, well, Myhrvold et al. Myhrvold et al. Modernist cuisine at home to be released on October 8th. So what's the story? Is this just an edited version of the original, or will there be new content? Can those of us that have the original safely give this a pass? Thanks, Joe. Listen, I got to be honest, I didn't have time to get in touch with any of those guys. So I don't know. I haven't read any of the pre-press on that. Like, you know, our heads have pretty much been in a hole because we got a lot of projects we're working on. So the outside world hasn't really been penetrating much. I don't know that they've... I think it's probably a redux of stuff that's in the larger book. It might have been represented somewhat or changed, but I don't think those guys have had the time to do anything. Let me put it this way. If that crew is going to do a totally fresh thing, they're going to put as much energy into it as they put into anything else they do, and I don't think they've had the time to do that. So it's probably going to be pulled from the other one, but I'm gonna, you know, if anyone else knows or wants to write in, I'm anxious to hear because I don't know. Okay, passing along this question. In my most recent article about the benefits of anesthetizing fish, lobsters, and crabs for enhanced flavors, I was wondering if I've ever tried doing the same with bivalves, and if so, whether it's made any difference in the flavor. Thanks, Craig. Okay, so we're talking about the recent, 2 weeks old now, cooking issues post on using anesthesia, specifically clove oil, on lobsters and crabs. And the theory is that if you anesthetize them before you kill them, they taste better, which is true. We've done that test many, many times. And they taste cleaner, sweeter. They're awesome. And plus, if you should feel bad about throwing a live crustacean into a pot of boiling water, this will allay your nervousness somewhat because they don't twitch. They don't move at all. They just sink to the bottom of the pot, and there's no sort of reaction from them at all. So I wrote about the technique of how to do that using clove oil that you get at Whole Foods. Plus, you know, or the benefits of just shoving a knife through them and taking out all of their ganglion and then boiling them. Problem with that being that you lose some of the juices on the inside of the lobster, and so you lose some of its taste. Anyway, question is, can you do that on bivalves? I don't know. I've never tried to anesthetize a bivalve. Bivalve meaning, I would guess, specifically clams and mussels, or, you know, perhaps something like a whelk or something else. I go, that's not a bivalve, that's a univalve, right? So if we're talking about mussels and clams and oysters, here's the problem. Clove oil water that you anesthetize things in has an aroma of cloves. And this is why when you're using clove oil, you have to be especially careful to not get it on your hands, because it becomes impossible to find out whether anything's been contaminated, because whenever you bring your hands to your nose to see what's going on, you smell cloves. When you're dealing with lobsters that are then going to get boiled, or you're dealing with fish that are going to get scrubbed and gutted, the clove oil flavor doesn't come through because it's been diluted twice, right? But like, it's not really, enough of it is not on the fish or the lobster or in the thing, so that you can detect it. But in a bivalve, where you have where part of its juices are the fluids in which it is sitting, then I'm pretty sure you're going to detect the aroma of clove. And so I don't think you'd be able to do a valid taste test between anesthetizing an oyster versus not. It's an interesting question, though. I've tried using gases to gas them open without much luck. You know, Myhrvold and Chris Young and those guys use a quick freeze with liquid nitrogen to shuck their oysters quickly to, you know, kill them quickly. I don't know how fast high hydrostatic pressure is, which is also used on oysters. I've never actually tasted one of those oysters. It's killed and pasteurized with high hydrostatic pressure, so I can't tell you whether they taste good or they taste bad. But there's a lot of other effects other than not cutting open a living creature in that scenario. What I have done with, and it's totally separate, has nothing to do with anesthesia, is I've put oysters, this is years and years ago, I would make flavored seawater. We used chicken stock with bacon in it. For oysters, we used to use carrot juice and cardamom. And I would add aquarium salt back to it to get it to be just like the ocean. And then I would have the oysters or clams drink the fluid, right? They would basically, I would put them in this, I would aerate it, I would, you know, keep it at the temperature that the clams and the oysters would want to feed at. They would feed, and then when you shucked the oyster, it would be bright orange. Like, so you'd have an oyster there in the shell, you'd shuck it, and it would be bright orange, and it would taste like carrots and cardamom. And that was a nifty trick. I haven't done that in a long time. Have I ever done that for you, Nastasha? Was that before? That was before you were working with us, but and it's been a long, long time since I've done it. But it's a fun little trick. Anyway, so that's for whatever it's worth, there, Craig. Anyway, you want to take a break?
Sure.
Let's take a break. Come back to cooking issues.
If you want to be a great chef, you can't learn everything from within the walls of a classroom. That's why the French Culinary Institute has evolved into the International Culinary Center. When you come here, you don't just learn basic culinary skills, you come to understand and to feel the whole culinary world. You have to network. You have to observe the true meaning of world-class performance. You have to intern at some of the world's great restaurants. At the International Culinary Center's campuses in New York, California, and Italy, we will expose you to the whole of the culinary world, one that is evolving daily at a very high speed. The International Culinary Center offers a wide range of courses, including culinary, pastry, and bread baking, to Italian, wine, management, culinary technology, and food writing. For more information, visit internationalculinarycenter.com.
The International Culinary Center. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Anyway, back at cooking issues. Call in your questions to 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. This one into Nastasha, myself.
Well, real quick, Andy Melka says, why the Y peeler? Feel like I'm going to peel my hand somehow. Love traditional straight peeler.
Well, I don't recommend peeling your hand. That would be a mistake.
That's good.
It's all about, hey, listen, here's the thing, right? Watch someone who's adept at a Y peeler. It's a different kind of a skill, right, from using it. So, but I know what you're, for those of you that don't know what we're talking about, this peeler looks like a Y. That's why they call it a Y peeler. Duh. And if you're not used to using it, what you feel like you're going to get is, like, let's say you're holding a potato. You're holding a potato in the palm of your hand, and your thumb and your index are, like, on it, right? And you're peeling down, and then you're using your thumb and index to rotate the potato as the Y peeler is going shap, 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 shap. And you do, if you're not used to it, get the feeling that you're going to nick your thumb somehow. But I haven't. You know what I mean? It's just like, I guess, getting used to it. But it's just, I mean, look at anyone who's really good with a Y peeler, and they're just much, much faster with it. I guess just because of the stroke. Now, what you don't get is that same feeling. So with a regular straight peeler, you're keeping the straight peeler kind of in between your four fingers in kind of like a, in a, I don't know, what would you call that kind of a palm I'm making?
Like
Kung Fu Iron Fist. Yeah. No, Black Power's a fist.
No.
Yeah. What the hell? But like kind of like a Kung Fu, like palm slap thing. And you're using your thumb, and you can pull the straight peeler towards you with a curl of your wrist. It's kind of like a snapping motion, but still not as fast as a really adept person with a Y peeler. Another thing, and I got to call in one second, with a Y peeler, like let's say you're doing carrots, you put the carrot flat on a baking sheet, and then you just the Y peeler is like slap, 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 as you're rotating the carrot underneath you, and the peels just go flying everywhere. It's amazing. Try the Y. Anyway, caller, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. How are you?
Good. Your show's great so far. I'm really enjoying it.
Oh, thanks.
I have a really silly question. Now, I always try to, like, whip my own whipped cream, and I don't know if it's because I'm buying ultra-pasteurized or I'm not whipping it at the right speed, but it's literally about two steps away from becoming butter. maybe you know what I'm doing wrong.
Yeah, I think you're probably just whipping too long. So
okay.
Usually when you're whipping your own cream, right, it's not going to be as hard or as stiff as the stuff that, you know, that is commercial out of a can, or you know what I mean? Because those guys add a lot of stabilizer. So I would start with like a really cold cream, get the highest fat content cream you can get. I've never done a lot of tests on ultra pasteurized versus not, but I can tell you that at the school they use a non-ultra pasteurized, a regular pasteurized cream, which is hard to get in supermarket, and it tastes better. It tastes better. And the cream we get is also a very high fat content cream, so it also whips up quite nicely. If you want to cheat and you want it a little bit stiffer, you could add stabilizers. And if you look at the label on whipped cream, especially the ones that are trying to reduce the fat content, they use light cream, and they stabilize the hell out of those things.
Okay.
Yeah, and that'll get it a little bit. But if you whip it even a little bit too much, what happens is cream is an oil in water emulsion. The continuous phase is water, and then if you over whip it, right, and then when you whip it, the fat is, you know, basically you're forming like a foam, and the fat's at the layer with air. If you over whip it, the fat starts to kind of agglomerate together, and the emulsion starts to invert. And if you go too long, obviously you get butter. But the first thing you get is that kind of grainy feel, and starts watering down a little bit. The texture loses, and you start getting a buttery taste to the whipped cream, which is not what you want.
I tried to make a peanut butter pie, so I was like, oh, this should be super duper easy. I'll just do it this way, and it still came out like really good, but it was like super thick and like not that aerated. And I'm like, ah, crap, what do I keep doing wrong? So
right, you could fortify, like, so you look at traditional mousse recipes, and they got their whipped cream, and they're fortified with like a gelatin mix afterwards. They're folded together, and that'll keep something like that pretty stiff. Over whipping. What else could be? I mean, that's the main thing, and you know, obviously something that people, I mean, I'm sure you know this already, but just to tell people, when you're whipping cream, don't forget to add salt to it, because it really pops the flavor.
Oh.
Yeah. A little bit. Not a lot.
Okay.
You don't want it salty, but it just really rounds out the flavor, makes it a lot better.
Oh, wow. I never knew that. Well, thanks so much for your help.
Hey, no problem. Hope it helps.
Yeah, thank you. Have a good one.
You too. All right. So, I was ranting about
potato.
Something before. Potato. Oh, the Y peeler. Anyway, yeah, I hit that. Okay, so by the way, Jack, this one's for you, and for anyone out there listening wants to download the podcast.
Uh-huh.
This is to everyone, including Indie Jesus. This is from Kevin. But remember, Indie Jesus is no longer with us. He doesn't work our shift anymore.
So
mainly,
you made it sound like he died.
No,
but he will rise again.
Jesus is all... you guys, man, you're going to get me in some big trouble.
Oh, man.
No, it's Indie Jesus hates Nastasha. That's the problem.
Yeah, that's my best guess.
Yeah. Anyway, first off, it's from Kevin. First off, enjoy the show and wanted to share a tip for anyone who's on the Android and doesn't have an iPhone. You can download Heritage Radio's RSS feed for the show into the Google Listen app, and it will automatically download and sync all the episodes over the air.
That's right.
I did not know that.
They're just MP3s.
Yeah, I did not know this. It used to be a huge pain to download the episodes one by one and copy them over USB, so I hope this helps some folks. Number two, this is from Kevin still. I have the opportunity to give talks on food science for Australia's National Science Week in Melbourne in August, although they pronounce it like Melbourne, right? Or no, how do they pronounce it?
Don't know.
I can't do it. I can't do the Australian version of Melbourne the way they pronounce it. So I'm going to say it like an American. Melbourne. Anyway, I'd like to tailor the message to the ingredients and cooking equipment available down there, i.e. in Melbourne. Do you have any experience working in Australia? And would you mind plugging my request to your Australian listeners? The best contact would be kevin@sciencefare.org. Fair as in food. F-A-R-E. Keep up the inspirational work. Kevin, I do not have any experience in Australia. I've never been to Australia. If there's anyone out there that wants to fly Cooking Issues down to Australia for any reason, we'll do it, right?
Right.
I'm sure, you know, if anyone from the Breville Corporation is listening, they can hook you up with some equipment, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, Breville, like, owns, like Australia's cooking implement universe, don't they? Breville. They love Momofuku. They love, like, you know, our partners Dave Chang. They love Christina Tozzi. Christina Tozzi's, I think her shop is basically constructed out of Breville pieces of equipment instead of bricks, because they have so much Breville equipment. True or false?
Yes.
Not honestly. I mean, it's like, you know, it's an I'm exaggerating. Anyway, Dave, Nastasha, and Jack. By the way, I always pronounce your name properly because I always mispronounce it.
Nastasia.
Yeah, I say Nastasha, and some people.
It's one syllable less.
Yeah, it's one syllable less because I'm a lazy, lazy son of a bitch. All right. Tom Fisher writes in, Dave, Nastasia, and Jack. Hope you had a great 4th of July. I've run into a snag. I've been making clarified fruit juices using your instructions for some time and recently started using them to make flavored ice cream. The juices were not strong enough on their own, so I froze them and remelted them, drawing off the concentrated juice. This worked well, but I got very inconsistent results as I have no way to determine the concentration of the juice. I remember you were mentioning a Brix refractometer to measure the concentration of sugar in solution. Will this work for my application as well? Many thanks, Tom Fisher. Hell yes. Yes. That's the easiest question I've ever had to answer. Yes. Now, here's what you got to do. You got to figure out, so you want the sugar content of the ice cream probably to be on the same order of concentration as a sorbet. And I can't remember off the top of my head what a proper Brix concentration for a sorbet is, but it's on the order of, I think, 20% sugar or something like that, like 17, 20. So I can't remember. So what you're going to want to do is figure out what percentage of your recipe is juice, right? And then figure out any other added sugar that you're going to add to it. And then you can calculate on a weight basis of your ice cream mix what the Brix, because all Brix means is percentage by weight that of a solution that is sugar. Okay? So, you know, let's say your mixture was going to be 1/4 fruit juice and it was going to be the only sugar that's in the recipe. Well, then you'd need a very high Brix, right? Because if you were looking for 20% of the thing to be sugar, and you wanted to add, you know, only a quarter of it being juice, almost all of it would have to be sugar. So, but that said, it's all doable, right? But what you need is you need a Brix refractometer. Most of the ones that people buy are 0 to 32 Brix, so they can only do from 0 to 32% sugar in a solution, and that's fine for fruit juice and fine for sorbet, but not fine if you're going to need to use something as concentrated as a simple syrup. Let's say typical simple syrup somewhere between 50 Brix normal, or rich simple syrup is going to be at like 66 Brix. So I use an electronic one that's a lot more expensive because I need to be very, very quick for the bar. But you can get a Brix refractometer that's 0 to 85% Brix, which will take care of a lot of what you're going to do for about $40-$50. If you want, you can buy two of the cheaper ones, one for the higher range and one for the lower range. The disadvantage of getting a single Brix refractometer that's an extremely wide range, like 0 to 85, is it's just not very accurate because it's hard to look into the refractometer and read the scale. But, you know, they're not complicated to use. They're easy to take care of. I've only ever had one person break one.
Me.
But yeah, go ahead and get them. And that's another one of those things. You know, if you ever need one, the needs are going to come up for it again and again. No one's ever said, man, I wish I didn't have that refractometer. You know what I mean? Okay. Have some Twitter questions that I'm going to take care of real quick before we go to our other commercial break. At Cooking Issues, have you ever run tests on centrifuges to clarify high-density items like bean puree? If so, would it be efficient? Okay. Well, yeah, no. We've done a lot of work, obviously, with nut oils, where we're trying to get the not obviously. I mean, only if you know me and have for years is it obvious. But we do a lot of work with nut oils, where we blend nuts, and we've done a bunch, right? Walnuts, pistachios, hazelnuts, Brazil nuts, macadamia nuts, bunch of nuts, pecans, peanuts, which aren't nuts. And blend them and then spin them in a centrifuge to extract the oil. And I wouldn't call it efficient, but it is delicious. I have spun tomato paste, and it's not efficient at all, but that tiny bit of juice that you get at the top of the tomato paste after you spin it is delicious. You tasted that, right, Stas? Mm-hmm. That was good. You would like that. It's incredibly inefficient, though. Well, and here for more inefficiency, Tony Canoliaro, our buddy at 69 Colbert Grow, who I'm going to see this week, I guess. He's going to be in New York before Tales, although I don't know when. He We're Tales of the Cocktail, by the way, next week. I'm probably going to have to do that show from New Orleans. Mm-hmm. I got to find out when my plane lands. He literally sticks whole olives in a centrifuge. Talk about paste. And spins them and gets a ridiculously small amount of ridiculously delicious product. I've never done bean puree. Your success is going to be based on two factors. One, how tightly bound is the water to the puree? And two, how much physical water is in the puree versus solids? Because a centrifuge at 4,000 times the force of gravity is only going to have a certain amount of separating capability. So I guess the answer, and it's not very helpful, is it depends. Not very helpful, huh?
No.
You could also try to use something that breaks the puree down. If the puree is basically based on pectin, you can use an enzyme to break down the pectin and increase your yield. It'll be at the expense, probably, of the texture of the paste that's left over, because you would want to be able to use both. Yeah? Okay. At Cooking Issues Heritage Radio, where to eat in Chicago? Coming from Dublin, Ireland, first time in Chi-Town. Where's interesting? Cheers. Well, unfortunately, I haven't been in a couple of years to Chicago, so I don't know what's hip and happening anymore. I mean, obviously, for the kind of work that we do, you're going to want to go to Alinea, but you got to book up kind of well in advance, right?
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that a lot of the places that I really want to go in Chicago, I haven't gone yet. Like, I haven't gone to Aviary, and I'm not plugged in Chicago anymore, unfortunately. Because it's been years, and I'm loath to recommend places that I haven't been yet. Right, Stas?
Right.
Is that fair?
Right.
Fair? But I would like readers to, or answer back on the Twitter. Answer me back on the at Cooking Issues on the Twitter and get some recommendations for eating in Chicago. Okay. Hey, Jack, you want to take one more commercial break?
Yeah, give me 1 second.
All right. 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. Cooking Issues.
Jack from Heritage Radio reminding all listeners that we are a 501c3 nonprofit organization, and you can donate to become a member today by visiting heritageradionetwork.org.
And welcome back. By the way, crazy guitar, right?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
That's Tim Power going crazy. Man, he was a nutty guitarist.
Any comments about the music from listeners on your end?
No, nobody. Look, it's like a freak show's college band from 1991. They're like, okay, we'll put up with it. I'm pretty sure that's what's going on.
Maybe.
Yeah, pretty sure. Although, again, like, one of the best parts about being in the Fallon show is getting to listen to the Roots play. Those guys are awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Did right? you get to hang out with Questlove at all?
I mean, look, those guys are busy. I mean, the way it works is, you know, I wanted to do something with him. It's going to be up, I guess, on their blog on Thursday. But he likes chocolate drinks, and this is his quote, not mine, so I don't want to hear anything. He also, like, he's accused by all of his buddies of liking, his words, not mine, bitch drinks. Right. And so, you know, he liked last time chocolate flavors, and he liked kind of drinks that tasted lighter. Mm. So I wanted to make a drink. For him, that it was also about the album that came out a year or two ago he did with Booker T, called The Road from Memphis, because obviously the bar's name is Booker and Dax, my son's Booker, and, you know, Booker T and Questlove and Chocolate and Beverage. So I made one, and we did a little, he and I did a little segment that's going to be on Fallon's blog, or is it NBC's or Fallon's? Fallon's blog sometime later this week. So yeah, I got to hang out a little bit.
Nice.
I think he liked the drink. He drank it.
Hmm.
So.
I met him at Milk Bar once. He was buying a lot of cookies.
Really?
Yeah.
He's a nice guy.
Yeah, really nice guy.
Yeah. Yeah. Impressive fro in the real life.
Very.
For more impressive even in real life than it is on the television. Anyway, got a question in, really interesting one actually. I'm just trying to find it on my machine here, from Mike. I've been reading a lot of Chinese cookbooks, and which is a good plan. I wonder which Chinese cookbooks you like. I've got to get the Fuchsia Dunlop books. I don't have those yet, but always a good plan reading Chinese cookbooks. Some talk about the importance of seasoning woks. The general method is to heat up oil and or lard and some sort of allium. Traditionally, garlic chives, but a combination of scallion and ginger is also recommended. They say that the heating process opens the pores of the metal. The aromatics permeate the metal, and the whole process helps create a nonstick surface. Could you please talk a bit about seasoning a pan? Is it crap, or is this something I should be doing? And if so, do you have a better method? Thanks, Mike. Excellent question. So the last time I spent a lot of time researching seasoning in general is when I did a post years ago on cast iron pans, in general cast iron pans. And seasoning is not crap. Seasoning is actually important. And there's a slight debate in the community about what exactly is going on when you're seasoning a pan. I think pretty much for me the accepted reason seasoning a pan is that you are creating you put a thin layer of oil and then fat, and when you heat it, the fat is breaking down and polymerizing and forming a polymerized oil film on top of the pan. It's binding with the pan, and it's that surface that is nonstick. Okay. And also, black. You have it there because it's black or it's brown. And it's the same sort of reaction that happens in oil paint when oil paints are dry, right? In oil paints, they use specifically something called a drying oil because it polymerizes and forms this kind of solid network. If you've ever seen vegetable oil that's spilled on a surface or been allowed to stay on a surface for a long time and it forms that yellow gunk, right? Stash, you know what I'm talking about, that yellow gunk?
Mm-hmm.
That is partially polymerized oil. That's what's going on. And it works. Now, there's another group that thinks it's a different kind of oxidized iron that's the same. It's, what is it called? Magnetite or whatever it is, that is the another form of iron oxide that's not rust, that's protective, and is a similar one that they use when you're bluing guns, blued steel for bluing guns, similar sort of thing. I don't think that's the case. I think it's the polymerized oil. Now, in a pan, when you're seasoning, a couple of things are important. First is that you want to a lot of people debate whether or not a particular kind of oil is more or less important. I don't really think it's that big of a deal. What you want to make sure of is that you don't put a thick, gloppy layer of oil on it when you're seasoning it. And the reason is that if you do, it's going to form thicker layers, and those layers will partially polymerize, but they're never going to be as tough or as uniform as lots of thin layers built up. And if you you'll see this, if you let a thin layer thick there, when you start scraping it down with a spatula, it'll dig into it and pieces of the seasoning will flake up, and that's not considered good. So that's why there's a lot of rubbing with paper towels. That's why when you're seasoning a pot in the oven, they turn them upside down so that any oil that is free, that's not been wiped around enough, drips off of the pan before it gets too polymerized and forms kind of little crappy spots. All right? So, I mean, the classic technique is multiple coatings of oil in an oven that is hotter than frying temperature. So like 450, I usually use something like that. Or like if you're seasoning a griddle, I'll season it directly. I can even season pans on a flame as long as you don't heat them up too much, because you can burn the seasoning off of a pan if you put it at like 650 in a self-clean cycle in an oven. You can burn the seasoning off of a pan. Although I don't know the exact temperature. Now, the interesting thing about the onions, the alliums, when you're seasoning a wok, and I looked into this. Before I get into the seasoning of the allium with the wok, let me say this. I don't have a lot of experience, because another thing I was interested in woks when the question came in is you know, what's the difference? Is there a difference in cooking capabilities or style or feel between a traditional hand hammered wok, which is made by taking a sheet of steel and hammering it into a wok shape, or a spun wok, where basically they take the disc and press it between two wooden chucks and spin it fast, and then use a stick to push the wok down into a wok shape, or a stamped wok, which is basically just, you know, a big hydraulic press, boom, stamps out the wok. And I don't know if there's a difference, and I wasn't able to find any sort of difference online. Now, there is a possibility, and you mentioned in your question porosity, and I think it is. No one has. I don't remember, because it has been a long time since I researched, but I don't think that I don't know what the difference is in porosity between different things. But I will say this: the surface of the pan does make a difference in how something works when it cooks. And let's go back to regular cast iron pans, which I have a lot more experience with. Modern cast iron cookware that is produced is basically straight from the cast. So if you look at the surface of a cast iron pan, it's got a little bit of a, I don't know, hard to say. Like, you know what I'm talking about? A little rough sandpapery look to it. And I don't like that, right? That's always got that little bit of a rough feel. Some people think that's going to actually enhance the non-stickness, because it decreases the actual area of contact of the food with the pan, which therefore less area to stick. That's why certain non-stick pans have those little dimples in the bottom. I think it's a horrible idea. The pans I like were sanded to show a bare metal surface at the bottom, something that they called polishing. But you could literally just take like a sander or a grinder to get that kind of sandpaper feel finish off the bottom of it. And those things take seasoning like a mother, and they come out like a black piece of glass. They're so slick. And my cast iron that is, you know, at least 50 years old, that was made that way, is the cast iron in my place that is the best in terms of non-stickness. It's great. And another thing, by the way, back to woks. When you're looking at a wok, some people are worried about using a metal spatula with their cast iron. Don't be worried about it. In fact, with a wok, you're always using a cast iron. It actually helps to knock a little bit. If you have a good seasoning on it, using something metal will help to knock little bits that will stick off and build up on your product. So don't worry about that. But the interesting part of your question, and something I hadn't thought about, was the reaction of the chives or garlic chives with the pan. And I don't think that it's horse hockey. I think that there's something to it. But because I watched a couple of videos of people seasoning woks online, here's a couple of things. First of all, most people don't cook with cut with carbon knives anymore, with knives that, in other words, that will stain, that aren't stainless. I have a couple in my house because I happen to like them. Everyone who has a carbon steel knife, one that, you know, will rust, will tell you that when you're cutting an onion, that onion will taste bad, especially if there's if it's not properly. Like, you know what? I got a quick call. I'll take the call in, and then I'll go back to onions and knives and wok season, because it's super interesting, at least to me. Hopefully to somebody else. Caller, you're on the air.
Hey, Dave. It's Brian here in San Francisco. How are you?
Doing well. Yourself?
Good, good. I wanted to thank you for answering my question about sugars a couple weeks ago, and so now I'm no longer paranoid about NutraSweet and all the artificial sugars.
Good, and your wife's okay with it? Everyone's good?
She hasn't dropped dead yet.
No, good, good, good. I had some NutraSweet last night, and I'm not dead.
What?
I had some NutraSweet just last night, and I haven't died yet. Although,
well, maybe you should. Maybe it'll take another couple days. We'll see.
Well, to be honest, though, but back on that, that's not actually, like, the fact that we haven't died yet isn't necessarily a good argument, because there are things. I'm not saying NutraSweet's one of them, because I don't think it is. There are things that take 20 years to kill you, like asbestos. Anyway, go ahead.
Right, or mad cow.
Yeah. There you go.
So my question has to do with the. I was reading the Modernist Cuisine, and they recommended putting a slab of like quarter inch or three quarter inch aluminum into your oven as a hack for pizzas. And I know you have some experience with hacking your oven, but I don't want to completely destroy and dismember mine. So I'm wondering what you think about that as a better technique than a pizza stone.
Hmm. So wait, they're telling you to put the pizza directly onto the aluminum?
Exactly.
Huh. Well, I've never tried it. I mean, here's the basic theory of operation. Have you ever filled? Okay, so if you have an oven that doesn't have a lot of power in it, and you fill that oven with stones, not just like one pizza stone, but a lot, you'll notice that it takes a long time for your oven to heat up because you have to put a lot. It's taking a lot of power to heat up those stones. Do you know what I'm saying? So I once had an oven
like
that
90 minutes.
Yeah, like a long time. I had an oven. I completely lined the inside, almost like it was a masonry oven, and hours it would take to heat up. So maybe they're thinking that's not a good tack to take with your oven. Aluminum, how thick were they saying?
They were saying 3/4 inch, but then I was reading Igola to Nathan said, oh, you could go down to 1/4 inch.
I don't know. But they
said aluminum just because it's light.
Right. Aluminum, well, here's a couple of things. So what you want to do with the crust, I'm assuming that their theory of operation is that they want to put a big and instantaneous heat wallop into the bottom of the crust, right?
Exactly.
Now, aluminum is a super fast conductor, one of the best. You know, it's like right up there with copper. Not as good as copper, but right up there in terms of heat. And the issue with it is that it doesn't store it transmits heat very quickly, but it doesn't store heat very well because it just doesn't. It's lighter, right? So it doesn't have as much mass, and it doesn't take that much energy to heat up a block of aluminum. So the advantage is your oven will heat it very quickly compared to other things. It will heat very evenly, right? And whatever heat energy is in it will be delivered to your pizza very quickly, and it also won't cool down that much because the oven can supply heat to it fairly quickly as well. So unlike a pizza stone, if you're going to make a bunch of pizzas with a pizza stone, you'll notice that it starts lagging after a couple of pizzas because you've exhausted the heat that is at the surface of the stone, and it's taking a long time for it to kind of replenish that heat because the stone doesn't heat up very quickly, whereas aluminum heats extremely quickly. Now, I'm sure because, you know, those guys are good at that. I'm sure those guys did the calculation of how much heat is really necessary to deliver to your pizza on an instantaneous basis to get that good crust, that good boost on the crust. And that's why they're getting whatever thickness of aluminum it is that they're getting, is so that there's enough energy in that ingot to zap your crust fast. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. Does it make a difference the kind of metal?
Yeah.
You said copper would be better.
Well, really expensive. You know what I mean?
Yeah, obviously, if you have a copper, then you know.
Yeah, and heavy.
Stainless?
No, awful.
No, would stainless steel work?
Yeah, awful. No, terrible. Yeah, stainless is terrible. So, when I was testing, before I was making my own red hot pokers for drinks, I would have slugs of different metals that I was using to heat over a flame and then heat drinks with, and stainless was just awful. It's a slow conductor. It's a very slow conductor of heat compared even to iron. Very slow.
Really?
Yeah, it's just it has the advantage of being non-reactive. Is all it's got. It's expensive, it's heavy, and it's slow. Which is why your good pots have a big chunk of aluminum in the bottom of them, and or copper, and then like a layer of stainless that your food actually touches. It's probably quite thin. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, stainless terrible.
Do you think you think this would be good for bread in addition to pizza, or would it be too hot for bread?
I think it would probably. It would probably work. It would depend on what temperature. I mean, obviously, you're not cranking your oven as high on you're not cranking your oven as high for bread as you are for a pizza. It's been many years since I've done very thorough research on bread baking and crust interactions, so I'd have to figure out whether you're actually getting any sort of benefit from the masonry surface other than the delivery of heat. But I don't see why it wouldn't work. I don't see why it wouldn't work. But
okay, I'll go for it.
If you can afford the thicker one, I would get the thicker one. You know what I mean?
Thicker slab.
Yeah. If you look online, go to McMaster.com. It's not cheap, but it's easy to obtain aluminum from them, and you can figure out there's most of this stuff goes by weight, but then sometimes there's a price break where if you start getting it thicker, all of a sudden the price jumps more than just the weight jump, and so you can kind of see where that sweet spot is. I looked it up a while ago, and I think it's somewhere around half inch that starts getting expensive to get bigger slabs, at least normally. Or if you have a car and you live outside of the major city, you could probably just go to aluminum supply and get it. But McMaster Car, they're everywhere. You could at least get an idea of prices. They're about 30% more than they should be at McMaster Car, but it'll give you an idea.
Okay, great. Thanks. Do you think I should season it?
Aluminum,
no. For our previous question?
No. Aluminum, no. No.
Okay.
Yeah. It forms its own oxide, right, and it's not. You're not going to be able to do anything good with it.
Okay, great.
All
right,
thanks
cool. so much.
Hey, no problem.
Have a good day.
You too.
All right. Jack says we have 1 more minute.
Oh, 1 more minute! All right, so when you take a carbon steel knife and cut through an onion, you'll see that it picks up a flavor, right? The onion picks up a flavor, and the onion tastes bad. And I did some more research, and old-timers used to rub onions on their knives to develop a patina on the knife. And I looked on the web, and people are now, kind of environmentally friendly corrosion inhibitors, making garlic extracts that they rub on knives as corrosion inhibitors on knives. So there is, and it's basically these sulfur compounds that are in onions, in alliums, in scallions, that are interacting with iron, right, to inhibit corrosion on a knife, but they also take up the bad flavors into the onions themselves. This is apparently the theory of operation in the stainless steel anti-onion smell on your hand thing, but I don't know if those work because those are stainless. It'd probably be better off using carbon steel blocks instead of stainless steel blocks to get rid of the onion flavor. So there is an interaction between onions and iron. The other thing is that if you look at people on the web seasoning with the chives, it's basically a way to scrape around and also move oil around so that oil is not sitting in one place. So the chives are the long chives or garlic chives are one kind of interacting with the metal, taking metal away from it. I don't think it's adding a good flavor to the pan. I think it's removing bad flavors from the pan, right? And absorbing those bad flavors onto the onion, absorbing any sort of free iron that's on the surface of it. Now, the other thing is that instead of onions, which don't act this way, the scallion things, because they're like paper when they wilt, they're almost like a scrubby pad that you're using along with the metal spatula to move the oil around so that you're not getting any caked on pieces of oil anywhere. So the theory is they're interacting with the metal to remove stuff that you don't want that's on there, and they're pushing the oil around in a nice way such that you have a nice even coating all the way around the pan. My bet, this is a good way to season it. Now, why scallions and not something like garlic? I don't know. I haven't used that much garlic chives with this sort of thing. I mean, I've used them, but not that much. If you were to use this with garlic, it would make a scorched, awful flavor, which would probably mess with you and mess with your pan. But chives don't have an awful flavor once they get charred. And so you can continue to use those chives all the way up until the char point, which is around where you're going to want to be to get accurate seasoning of the pan to get it nice and black. And there you have it. Cooking the Jews!
Vicious. Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening. Get it straight.